Side 7, All Tomorrow's Parties, by William Gibson, continuing on page 251. Laney knows the story of Jennifer Moe. It has haunted him since he first read it several years ago as a classified government document. Why hasn't it gotten you, Harwood? Why hasn't it kicked in?
Perhaps because I'm too perfectly self-obsessed to become interested in anyone else. It's been all gravy for me, the next best thing to knowing the future. Better, actually. Just that little degree of free will, and we're so much more happy, aren't we? And looking backward is very nearly as much fun as looking forward, though our digital soup does thin out rather rapidly that way down the timeline. Amazing, though. That business around Curie's husband changed everything, and who knows? I ask you, Laney, who knows?
We do.
Yes, we do.
It's changing again. Tonight.
This morning, rather. Pacific Standard, very early. But yes, it is. And I'm here to see that it changes in the directions I prefer it to, and not in others.
We're going to try to stop you.
Of course. That's the shape of things tonight, isn't it? I couldn't expect otherwise. Now Laney feels two things simultaneously. A coldness, physical and inescapable, rising beneath his heart, and the secret, ranked presence of the individual inhabitants of the walled city, arrayed behind him like clay soldiers set to march forever across the floor of an emperor's tomb. Yet these will move, should Laney require them, and he senses as well the presence of Retoe, and he knows that the configuration is not yet complete.
She's here, Laney. She's in the flow. You've done that, you and your friends, but it won't help now because I'm going where you won't find me, for the duration, till the deal is done. Your friends aren't the only ones who learned how to secede. And with the cold rising around his heart, Laney knows that this is true, that Harwood is going now, inverting himself into an informational wormhole of the sort the walled city exists within, and reaches down. It seems like down, though in this place there is neither direction nor ordination. A legion reaching with him to find.
62.
Los Proyectos.
Silencio is remembering the rusting cans of fire in the yards of Los Proyectos, how the men stand and spit and warm their hands. Playboy and Raton, he had met around such a fire. And now there is the smell of the cans in this room. And he is frightened. And even this kind one who makes her own light and speaks to him in the language of his mother, but kind, will not keep the fear away. And he wishes only to return to the watches, to their faces and conditions and values, this universe that has discovered him, this mode of being, without which there is only the fear. Crouching here on the black man's bed, the kind one glowing beside him, he feels the fear come very big, and the black man in the closet throwing things out, and Silencio wants only the watchers. At the edge of his mind, wait men with dog's teeth and wings, their faces blacker than the face of the black man with the watchers. Their faces are the black of the drug men rub into their gums.
Bring the projector closer, she tells the man,
this one who stilled Playboy and Raton, and Silencio sees that for the first time she speaks. She is another. Her hair, smooth gold, the bones of her face, another's bones.
Bring the notebook. Be very careful of the cable.
And the man shifts the silver thing Silencio fears. Now Silencio fears everything, closer, and brings the watchfinder to the bed, still on its wire.
Connect the iPhones, quickly.
The man puts the wire from the hat into the watchfinder and hands Silencio the hat. Inside, Silencio sees, are the pictures that fit against the eyes. and they are pictures of the watch on the screen of the finder, and Silencio feels relief, the fear moving away, back to the edge of things where the dog-toothed men are. He puts the hat over his eyes, and is in another place. Nothing up or down, but something spreading forever, wider than the yards of Los Proyectos, or any other space he has ever seen. But the one who shines is there, and beside her another, less clear. "This is Mr. Laney," she says, in the language of Silencio's mother. "You must help him. He needs to find a watch. This watch." And she holds in her palm the watch Silencio had seen on the screen. It's a LeCoultre Futurematic, a backwinder, black dial, with wind reserve. Silencio knows its serial number, its bid history, its number in today's auction. "Someone is taking it away, and you must follow it." Silencio looks from the beautiful face of the Futurematic to the face of the woman. "You must find it for him." And the watch is gone, and she is gone, and the other with her, leaving Silencio in that place that is only wide and without color or shape. And Silencio thinks he might cry now. But very far away, he feels it, the watch. He knows it, and it is there still, but only this distance, these gray fields of light. Gone again. No. There is the system of all the watches, similarities, differences, the words, a coding. Nothing is lost within the system, and the Futurematic rises inside as though it were lifting through clear water. It is within his grasp. And gone again. Blankness. No. He wants it. He enters the system again. He crosses the gray fields, seeing only the Futurematic, where it has gone. 63. Funicular. Rydell had had a certain amount of riot control training in Knoxville and knew something in theory anyway about fires and natural disasters, but nothing had prepared him for the weirdness of clinging one-handed to the back of an ATV while Elmore, the meshback Chevette's friend had somehow talked into driving, gunned it back toward Bryant Street through the bridge's upper level. Rydell had never seen a vehicle here before, aside from bicycles, and he suspected that under normal circumstances they wouldn't have been allowed to get very far. But these were not normal circumstances, nor was this in any way a normal place. People were boiling out of the upper units of the squatters community like ants out of a broken nest, and what struck Rydell about it now was the quiet with which they were doing it. These were not, in some sense, civilians, but hardened survivors, used to living on their own in a community of similar people. There were a few people screaming, and probably running the wrong way, or in circles, but from the moving vantage point of the bucking, pitching ATV it was hard to tell. Rydell's impression was mainly of determination. They'd decided that the place was burning, and they'd decided they were getting out. Most people seemed to be carrying something. A few were carrying small children, more carried household goods, and Rydell had seen at least three carrying guns. Elmore's style of getting through the crowd was straightforward. He'd gun it toward whoever was in his way, sounding an irritating little horn that Rydell suspected nobody was hearing anyway, and trust that people would get out of his way, which they managed to do, some just barely, until the ATV's right back wheel clipped a stack of yellow plastic vegetable crates and brought that down on top of a couple of heavily tattooed characters in lederhosen and paint-splattered construction boots. Elmore had to hit the brakes then, and Rydell saw Chevette flip off. He couldn't grab her because he had the chain gun in the hand nearest her and no way to put it down. Blocked by the pile of empty yellow crates, Elmore whipped it into reverse, pulled back about 4 feet, and popped it, plowing into the crates and the men in lederhosen, who promptly went lateral, swarming over the pile of crates and grabbing Elmore, who didn't look to Rydell like fighting material. "Get off him!" Chevette's girlfriend shouted, trying to keep from being pulled from the saddle with the driver. Rydell slung the chain gun up and put it in the face of one of the tattooed men. The guy blinked at it, looked Rydell in the eye, and started to go after him,
but some cop reflex caused Rydell to bellow, "LAPD, get on the ground!" which made absolutely no sense under the circumstances, but seemed to work. "This is a gun," he added, and remembered Fontaine's advice that the chain gun was anything but directional. "You people are crazy," snapped one of the tattooed men, bare-chested and elaborately inked, scrambling over the yellow crates, the light catching on a round steel stud in his lower lip. His partner was right behind him. Rydell jumped down and found Chivette struggling to extricate herself from what seemed to be a pile of squashed eggplant. As he was turning back to the ATV, he saw a woman with a crew cut and serious biceps tackle Elmore, who went over into the crates. "Where's Tessa?" "I don't know," said Rydell, taking Chivette's hand. "Come on." As soon as they were away from the ATV, which in any case wasn't going anywhere, Rydell began to get the idea that something was seriously wrong here. While most of the way from Fontaine's people had been running toward Bryant, now he saw they were running back. And now you could see the fear. "I think it's burning there by the ramp," Rydell said. He could see the smoke now, and Rydell noticed how quickly it was thickening. "Where's Tessa?" "Lost her." A young girl came running, screaming, with her shirt on fire, from the direction of the city. Rydell tripped her, handed Chivette the chain gun, and bent to roll the girl over, smothering the flames. The girl just kept screaming, and then she was up and running, though Rydell saw that her shirt had been extinguished. He took the chain gun back from Chivette. "We don't want to try that way," he said. He didn't want to think about what might be happening there if the crowd was trying to force its way through flame. "Come on, let's try this." He tugged her through the doorway of a cafe, deserted, cups of coffee on the tables, music playing calmly, steam rising from a pot of soup on a hot plate behind the counter. He pulled her behind the counter and into the tight little kitchen, but found that while there were windows, they'd been barred against thieves with elaborately welded grids of rebar. "Shit," he said, leaning to peer through the salt-crusted pane, trying to estimate the drop here, in case they could find a way. Now it was her turn to grab him, pull him out, but she pulled him out into the path of a fresh batch of panicked bridge people, fleeing whatever was happening toward Bryant. They both went down, and Rydell saw the chain gun drop through a hole sawn in the deck to admit a bundle of sewage tubing. He braced for an explosion when the thing hit bottom, but none came. "Look," Chivette said, getting to her feet, pointing. "We're at the foot of Skinner's Tower. Let's try to get up there." "There's no way off that," Rydell protested, his side killing him as he got up. "There's nothing to burn either," she said, "once you're past the Ponix operation." "Smoke'll get us." "You don't know that," she said, "but down here it'll get us for sure." She looked at him. "I'm sorry, Rydell."
"Why?"
"Because I was trying to make all this your fault."
"I sure hope it's not," he said.
"How have you been?"
Rydell grinned, in spite of everything, that she'd ask him this now.
"I missed you," he said.
She hesitated.
"Me too."
Then she grabbed his hand again, heading for the plastic around the foot of the cable tower. It looked as though people had cut their way out. Chivette stepped through a 5-foot slit. Rydell ducked to follow her, into warm jungle air and the smell of chemical fertilizer. But there was smoke here, too, swirling under the glare of the grow lights. Chivette started coughing. Shadows of people fleeing raced across the translucent plastic. Chivette went to a ladder and started climbing. Rydell groaned.
"What?"
She stopped and looked down.
"Nothing," he said,
starting up after her, biting his lip each time he had to raise his arms. In the distance he could hear sirens, a weird rising cacophony that blended together, wove in and out, like a concert performed by robot wolves. He wondered if it had sounded like that in the minutes after the little big one. He really didn't know how much of this ladder he could manage. It was metal, stuck to the wall with that super goop they used here, and he looked up and saw Chivette's plastic-cleated feet vanish through a triangular opening. And he realized he was smiling, because that really was her, and those really were her feet, and she'd said she'd missed him.
The rest of the way didn't seem so hard, but when he got up and through, sitting on the edge of a breather, he saw that she'd started to climb up the slanted girder, hanging on to either side of the blunt-toothed track that the little car,
which he could just make out up on the top, ran on.
"Jesus," Rydell said, imagining himself having to follow her. "Stay there," she said, over her shoulder. "I'll try to bring it down for you."
Rydell watched her climb, worried about grease, but she just kept going, and soon she was there, climbing into the car, which from here looked like one of the waste bins out behind Lucky Dragon, but smaller.
Rydell heard an electric engine whine. With a creak, the little car, Chevette in it, started down.
He got to his feet, and the smoke caught in his lungs, his side stabbing him each time he coughed.
"Somebody's been up here," she said, when she reached the bottom. "The grease shows it. I was up here earlier looking around, and there was dust on it."
"Somebody probably lives here," Rydell said, looking around at the dark, flimsy walls that sheathed the tower 12 feet up from the platform he stood on. He climbed into the car, and she pushed a button. The car groaned, creaked, and started up the girder. The first thing Rydell wasn't prepared for as they cleared the screening wall was the extent of the fire. It looked as though the end by Bryant was completely aflame, huge clouds of black smoke billowing up into the night sky. Through that, he could see the lights of emergency vehicles, dozens of them it looked like, and above the creaking of the cogwheel, he could still hear the concert of wailing sirens.
"Jesus," he said.
He looked in the other direction toward Treasure, and that was burning too, though it didn't seem as intense, but maybe that was just distance.
"You got a flashlight?" Chevette asked.
He unzipped his Lucky Dragon fanny pack and fished out a little Lucky Dragon disposable he'd helped himself to back in L.A. Chevette twisted it on and started up the ladder that led to the hole in the floor of the little tower-top cube she'd lived in when Rydell had met her. Just a square opening there, and he saw her shine the light into it.
"It's open," she said, not too loud, and that made Rydell start up after her.
When he climbed through into the single room, she was shining the light around. There was nothing here, just some garbage. There was a round hole in one wall where Rydell remembered there had been an old stained glass window before. He saw the expression on her face in the glow from the flashlight.
"It's really not here anymore," she said, as if she didn't quite believe it herself. "I guess I thought it would still be here."
"Nobody lives here now," Rydell said, not sure why he had.
"Roof hatch is open, too," Chevette said, shining the light up.
Rydell went to the old ladder, bolted to the wall, and started up, feeling damp, splittery wood against his palms. He was starting to get the idea this might have been a very bad idea climbing up here, because if the whole bridge were going to burn, they probably weren't going to make it. He knew the smoke was as dangerous as the fire, and he wasn't sure she understood that. And the second thing he wasn't prepared for, as he stuck his head up through the hatch, was the barrel of a gun thrust into his ear. His buddy, with the scarf. 64. Tag. And as Harwood recedes, and the rest of it as well, amid this spreading cold, and Lainey feels, as at a very great distance, his legs spasming within their tangle of sleeping bags and candy wrappers, Reitoe is there, and passes him this sigil, clock face, round seal, the 12 hours of day, 12 of night, black lacquer and gold numerals, and he places it on the space that Harwood occupied, and sees it drawn in, drawn infinitely away into that place where Harwood is going, drawn by the mechanism of inversion itself, and then it is gone. And Lainey is going too, though not with Harwood.
"Gotcha,"
Lainey says, to the dark in his fetid box, down amid the subsonic sighing of commuter trains and the constant clatter of passing feet, and finds himself in Florida sunlight, upon the broad concrete steps leading up to the bland entrance to a federal orphanage. A girl named Jennifer is there, his age exactly, in a blue denim skirt and a white t-shirt, her black bangs straight and glossy, and she is walking heel to toe, arms outstretched for balance, as if along a tightrope, down the very edge of the topmost step, balancing so seriously, as if
Were she to fall, she might fall forever. And Lainey smiles to see her, remembering the orphanage's smells, jelly sandwiches, disinfectant, modeling clay, clean sheets. And the cold is everywhere now, somewhere, but he is home at last. 65. Open air. Fontaine, wielding the axe now, reflects that he has lived quite a long time, and yet this experience is new. To lift the heavy head above his own and bring it down against the shop's rear wall, the plywood booming. He's a little surprised at how it simply bounces off. But with his next swing, he's reversed the head so that the sharp 4-inch spike, rather than the blade, contacts the wall, and this digs most satisfyingly in, and on the third blow penetrates, and he redoubles his efforts. "Need some air," he says, as much to himself as to the two seated on his bunk, the gray-haired man and the boy with his head down, lost in the helmet again. To look at these two, you'd think there was no problem, that the bridge wasn't burning. Where'd that hologram girl go? Still, this chopping is getting somewhere, though his arms are already aching. Hole there the size of a saucer and getting bigger. No idea what he'll do when he's got it big enough, but he likes to keep busy. And this is the way it always is for Fontaine. When he knows that things are bad, very bad indeed, and very likely over, he likes to keep busy. 66. Bulk lift. Chevette climbs through the hatch in the roof of Skinner's room to find Rydell kneeling there in his lucky dragon security bib, but the critical factor here is the man from the bar, the one who shot Carson, who's got a gun pressed into Rydell's ear and is watching her and smiling. He's not much older than she is, she thinks, with his black buzz cut and his black leather coat, his scarf wrapped just so, casual, but you know he takes time with it, and she wonders how it is people get this way, that they'll stick a gun in someone's ear, and you know they'll use it. And why does it seem that Rydell finds people like that? Or do they find him? And behind him, she can see a plume of water arcing higher than the bridge, and knows that that must be from a fireboat, because she's seen one used when a pier on the Embarcadero burned. God, it's strange up here now, with the night sky all smoke, the flames, lights of the city swimming and dimmed as the smoke rolls. Little glowing red worms are falling, winking out all around her, and the smell of burning. She knows she doesn't want Rydell hurt, but she isn't afraid. She just isn't now. She doesn't know why. Something on the roof beside her, and she sees that it's a glider up on its own little frame, staked to the asphalt-coated wooden roof with bright, sharp spikes, and other things piled beside it, black nylon bags, what she takes to be bedding. Like someone's ready to camp here if they need to, and she understands the buzz-cut boy wanted to be covered if he had to stay to hide. And it comes to her that probably he's responsible for the burning of the bridge, and how many dead already, and he's just smiling there like he's glad to see her, his gun in Rydell's ear. Rydell looks sad, so sad now. "You killed Carson," she heard herself say.
"Who?"
"Carson, in the bar."
"He was doing a pretty good job putting your lights out."
"He was an asshole," she said, "but you didn't have to kill him."
"Fortunately," he said, "it isn't about who's an asshole. If it were, our work would never be done."
"Can you fly this?" pointing at the glider.
"Absolutely." "I'm going to take this gun out of your ear now," he said to Rydell.
He did.
She saw Rydell's eyes move. He was looking at her.
The boy with the buzz cut hit him in the head with the gun. Rydell toppled over, lay there like a big broken doll. One of the glowing red worms fell on his stupid pink bib, burned a black mark.
"I'm going to leave you here," he said. He pointed the gun at one of Rydell's legs. "Kneecap," he said.
"Don't!"
she said. He smiled.
"Lay down over there, by the edge, on your stomach." The gun never moved. She did as she was told.
"Put your hands behind your head."
She did.
"Stay that way." She could watch him out of the corner of her eye, moving toward the glider. The black fabric of its simple triangular wing was catching a breeze now, thrumming with it. She saw him duck under the kite-like wing and come up within the carbon fiber framework extending beneath it. There was a control bar there. She'd seen people fly these on Rio 1. He still had the gun in his hand, but it wasn't pointed at Rydell. She could smell the asphalt caked on the roof. She remembered spreading it with Skinner on a hot, windless day, how they heated the hard bucket of tar with a propane ring. The world Skinner had helped build was burning now, and she and Rydell might burn now with it, but the boy with the buzz cut was ready to fly. "Can you make it to the Embarcadero with that?" "Easily," he said. She saw him shove the gun into the pocket of his black coat and grip the bar with both hands, lifting the glider. The breeze caught at it. He walked into the wind, reminding her somehow of a crow walking, one of those big ravens she'd grown up seeing in Oregon. He was within a few feet of the edge now, the side of Skinner's room that faced China Creek. "You and your friend here caused me a great deal of trouble," he said. "But you're either going to burn to death or asphyxiate now, so I suppose we're even." He looked out, stepped forward. And Chivette, without having made any conscious decision at all, found herself on her feet, moving, drawing the knife Skinner had left for her, and ripping it down as he stepped from the edge through the black fabric, a 3-foot slash from near the center and straight out through the trailing edge. He never made a sound then, as he went fluttering down, faster, spinning like a leaf, until he struck something and was gone. She realized that she was standing at the very edge, her toes out over empty air, and she took a step back. She looked at the knife in her hand, at the pattern locked there by the beaten links of motorcycle chain. Then she tossed it over, turned, and went to kneel beside Rydell. His head was bleeding from somewhere above the hairline. His eyes were open, but he seemed to be having trouble focusing. "Where is he?" Rydell asked. "Don't move your head," she said. "He's gone." The breeze shifted, bringing them smoke so thick the city vanished. They both started to cough. "What's that sound?" Rydell managed, trying to crane his neck around. She thought it must be the sound of the fire. But it resolved into a steady drumming, and she looked out to see, just level with her, it seemed, the block-wide, impossible brow of a greasy gray bulk lifter, Omaha Transfer, painted across it in letters 30 feet high. "Jesus Christ," she said, as the thing was upon them, its smooth, impossibly vast girth so close she might touch it. And then it jettisoned its cargo, close to 2 million gallons of pure glacial water, destined for the town south of Los Angeles. And she could only cling to Rydell and keep her mouth shut against the weight and the surge of it. And then she was somewhere else, and drifting, and it seemed so long, since she'd slept. 67. Silver Castle. In the gray field, Silencio finds a silver castle, an empty place, and somehow new. There are no people here. Only empty hallways, and he wonders why someone would build such a thing. The system of the watches leads him deeper, deep within, each hallway like the last, and he is tired of this, but the Futurematic is there still, and he will find it. And when he does at last, in a very small room, at the root of the silver world, he discovers that he is not alone. There is a man. And the man looks at Silencio and does not believe Silencio is there. And the man's eyes fill with a fear that Silencio feels must mirror his own fear. And Silencio wishes to tell the man he has only come here to find the watch, because it is part of the system of hands and faces and applied numerals, and Silencio means no harm. But the man's eyes are like the eyes of those to whom Raton shows the knife. And someone coughs behind Silencio, and turning, Silencio sees a terrible man, whose head is a cloud of blood, and whose mouth is open in a red-toothed scream, and the mouth does not move when this man says,
Hello, Harwood.
But now, somehow, he is with the Bright One again. She tells Silencio to remove the hat, and he does. Inside it, the pictures of the castle fading, and the room is filled with smoke. And out through the broken door is more smoke, and the black man, the gray branches of his hair hanging limp now, has cut a hole in the wall with his axe. Not a big hole, but he puts his head and shoulders out through it now. And Silencio sees him jerk as if something strikes him, and he draws back inside, eyes wide and wet, wet, running with water, and water is falling past the hole, and the gray hair sticks in its tangles to the man's face. And now more water comes down, into the tunnel like a street, beyond the door. So much water. And the man in the long coat is standing there, hands in his pockets, and he watches the water come down, and Silencio sees the lines in this man's cheeks deepen. Then this man nods to Silencio, and to the black man, and goes out through the broken door. Silencio wonders if it is wet in the silver castle, too. 68. The Absolute at Large. Boomzilla in the Lucky Dragon, back in there for what he knows is the first time they work this Lucky Dragon nanofax. Not a game, but how you copy solid shit from one store to another. Not sure he gets that, but there's free candy and big drinks for the kids, of which he is opting to be very definitely one right now, but it's gone sideways with the bridge burning. And those motherfucker bulk lifters come drop a fuckload of water on it. Got about 100 fire trucks and everything here. Police, tactical squads, helicopters up in the air. So Lucky Dragon can't do the special thing for the first time they use the Lucky Dragon nanofax. Manager's going lateral, walks the aisle talking to himself. But the store's doing business big time. Home office won't let him close. And Boomzilla's started eating candy bars free because the securities are watching the smoke still rise off the wet black garbage, all that's left this end. So you can see the real bridge there, the old part, black too, hanging out in the air like something's bones. And finally the manager comes and reads from a notebook, "Ladies and gentlemen, this momentous occasion, jaw, jaw, and now they are placing the first object in the unit in our Singapore branch." Boomzilla sees on TV out in the pylon. It's a gold statue of the Lucky Dragon himself, smiling. And it will now be reproduced at a molecular level in every branch of our chain throughout the world. Checker and two securities, they clap. Boomzilla sucks on the ice in the bottom of his big drink. Waits. Lucky Dragon Nanofax has a hatch on the front Boomzilla could fit through, he wanted to, and he wonders, would that make more Boomzilla's other places, and could he trust those motherfuckers? If he could, he'd have a tight posse. But he doesn't trust anybody, why should they? Light over the hatch turns green, and the hatch slides up, and out crawls, unfolds, sort of, this butt-naked girl. Black hair, maybe Chinese, Japanese, something. She's long and thin. Not much titties on her, the way Boomzilla likes, but she's smiling, and everybody... The manager, checker, securities, they jaw hang, eyes popped. Girl straightening up, still smiling, and walks fast to the front of the store, past the security counter, and Boomzilla sees her reach up and open the door, just right on out. And it'll take more than a naked Japanese girl to get anybody's attention out there, in the middle of this disaster shit. But the crazy thing is, and he really doesn't get this, standing, looking out through the doors of the video pylon, so that he has to go outside and fire up his last Russian Marlboro to think about it after, is that when he sees her walk past the screens there, he sees her on every last screen, walking out of every Lucky Dragon in the world, wearing that same smile. Boomzilla's still thinking about this when his Marlboro's done, but thinks it's time for a Lucky Dragon mufflet microwave. He thinks of that as his businessman's breakfast, and he's got the money, but when he gets back in, they got no mufflet, fucking firemen ate them all. Fuck that, he tells them. Why don't you fax me one from fucking Paris? So security throws his ass out. 69. Everything takes forever. Rydell wakes to pain. In what has been the nearest approximation of heaven he's known. This miraculously dry, brand-new, extremely high-tech sleeping bag curled beside Chevette, his ribs on fire, and lies there listening to the helicopters swarming like dragonflies, wondering if there's maybe something bad for you in the stuff that holds duct tape on. They'd found this bag, hermetically sealed in its stuff sack, in the wake of the flood, snagged on one of the spikes that held the scarf's hang glider rack to the roof, and no more welcome find there ever was to get out of wet clothes and into dry warmth, the bag's bottom water and probably bulletproof as well, a very expensive piece of ordnance, and lie there, watching two more bulk lifters come, huge, slow-moving cargo drones diverted from their courses, it will turn out, according to a plan arrived at several years before by a team of NoCal contingency planners, to dump still more water, extinguishing the fire at the treasure end and damping down the central span as well. And each one, depleted and limp, starting to rise immediately, free of ballast, in a sort of awkward elephantine ballet. And held each other up there into the dawn, sea breeze carrying away the smell of burning. Now Rydell lies awake, looking at Chevette's bare shoulder, and thinking nothing much at all, although breakfast does begin to come to mind after a while, though he can wait.
Chevette?
Voice from some tinny little speaker. He looks up to see a silver Mylar balloon straining on a tether, camera eye peering at them. Chevette stirs.
Tessa? Are you okay?
Yeah, she says, voice sleepy. What about you?
It's a feature,
the voice from the balloon says.
Action! Big budget! I've got footage you won't believe!
What do you mean, it's a feature?
I'm signed! They flew up this morning! What are you doing up there?
Trying to sleep, Chevette says, and rolls over, pulling the bag over her head. Rydell lies watching the balloon bob on its tether, until finally he sees it withdrawn. He sits up and rubs his face, rolls out of the bag and stands stiffly, a naked man with a big patch of silver duct tape across his ribs, wondering how many TV screens he's making right now. He hobbles over to the hatch and climbs down into darkness, where he relieves himself against a wall.
Rydell?
Rydell starts, getting his ankle wet. It's Creedmoor, sitting on the floor, knees up, wet look head between his hands.
Rydell,
Creedmoor says, you got anything to drink? What are you doing up here, Buell?
Got in that greenhouse thing down there. Thought there'd be water there. Then I figured my ass would boil like a fucking catfish, so I climbed up here, sons of bitches.
Who?
I'm fucked, Creedmoor says, ignoring the question. Randy's canceled my contract and the goddamn bridge is burned down. Some debut, huh? Jesus!
You could write a song about it, I guess. Creedmoor looks up at him with utter despair. He swallows. When he speaks, there is no trace of accent. Are you really from Tennessee?
Sure,
Rydell says. I wish the fuck I was, Creedmoor says, his voice small but loud in the hollow of this empty wooden box, sunlight falling through the square hole above, lighting a section of 2x4s laid long way up to make a solid floor.
Where you from, Bew?
Rydell asks.
Son of a bitch, Creedmoor says, the accent returning. New Jersey!
And then he starts to cry. Rydell climbs back up and stands on the ladder with just his head out, looking toward San Francisco. Whatever Laney was on about, that end-of-the-world thing, everything changing, it looked like it hadn't happened. Rydell looks over at the black mound of sleeping bag and reads it as containing that which he most desires to cherish. And the wind shifts, catching his hair, and when he climbs the rest of the way, back up into sunlight, he still hears Creedmoor weeping in the room below. 70. Courtesy call. In the cab to Transamerica, he closes his eyes, seeing the watch he gave the boy where time arcs in one direction only across a black face
interior time gone rudderless now, unmoored by a stranger's reconstruction of Lise's face. The hands of the watch trace a radium orbit, moments back to back. He senses some spiral of unleashed possibility in the morning, though not for him. The bridge, behind him now, perhaps forever, is a medium of transport become a destination. Salt air, scavenged neon, the sliding cries of gulls. He has glimpsed the edges of a life there that he feels is somehow ancient and eternal. Apparent disorder arranged in some deeper, some unthinkable fashion. Perhaps he has been too long in the pay and the company of those who order the wider world. Those whose mills grind increasingly fine toward some unimaginable omega point of pure information, some prodigy perpetually on the brink of arrival, which he senses somehow will never now arrive, or not in the form his career's employers have imagined. In the atrium, he describes the purpose of his visit as a courtesy call. He is disarmed, searched, cuffed, and taken, per Harwood's orders, by his seven captors into an elevator. And as its doors close, he feels grateful that they are excited and inexperienced, and have cuffed his hands in front rather than behind his back. By the time the express elevator reaches Harwood's office floor, he will be alone. He touches the buckle of his belt, and thinks of the simple yet perfectly efficient tool concealed between the layers of fine Italian calf. And exists in the moment. 71. Yamazaki. Yamazaki, grim and nervous, descends into the early morning rush hour accompanied by a very large Australian, shaven-headed, with one mutilated ear.
"You knew he was here?" the large man asks.
"He desired secrecy," Yamazaki says. "I am sorry."
Yamazaki leads the Australian to the cardboard city and points out Laney's carton and its entrance.
"This one?"
Yamazaki nods. The Australian produces a knife that telescopes silently at the touch of a button, both its edges serrated. He slits the top from Laney's carton, lifting it like the lid of a box of cereal, and Yamazaki sees the stickers of Cody Harwood that he glimpsed once before. The Australian, much taller than Yamazaki, stands staring down into the carton. Yamazaki himself is not yet ready to look.
"What was he running from?" the Australian asks.
Yamazaki looks up at the man's small, fiercely intelligent eyes, set in a face of the most abiding brutality.
"Toward," Yamazaki says. "He ran toward something."
A train arrives in the depths of the system, shunting a wall of stale, warm air toward the surface streets, and a new day. 72. Fontaine. Fontaine comes back from the blackened ribs toward Bryant with a jug of water and two Red Cross sandwiches. It's strange out there, very much the post-disaster scenario, and not to his liking. Media vehicles outnumber emergency, though there are plenty of those. The body count is remarkably low, he gathers, and puts this down to the nature of bridge folk, their seriousness in survival, and a certain belief in unorganized cooperation. Perhaps, he thinks, he'll never know what any of this was about in terms of causality, though he's sure he's been witness to something. He hopes Chevette and her boyfriend have made it through. But somehow he assumes they have. And the professor has gone, off about whatever business a man of his sort pursues, and that is business best not known about. Marshall will have to be told that his chain gun is gone, but that's just as well. Opposite his shop, someone has sprayed a great deal of that stuff called kills, lest the smear that the chain gun left there prove seropositive in any troublesome way. As he comes up to the shop, he hears the sound of someone sweeping broken glass, and sees that it is the boy, flat-footed in his big white shoes, and sees that the kid's done quite a good job of it, really,
down to rearranging things on the surviving shelves. That silver piece of hardware, like an oversized cocktail shaker, enjoys pride of place up behind the glassless frame of Fontaine's counter, between lead soldiers and a pair of trench art vases beat from the Kaiser's cannon casings.
"Where'd she go?"
Fontaine asks, looking up at this. The boy stops sweeping, sighs, leans on his broom, says nothing.
"Gone, huh?"
The boy nods.
"Sandwiches," Fontaine says, handing one to the boy. "We're going to be roughing it out here for a while."
He looks up at the silver canister again. Somehow he knows it no longer contains her, whoever, whatever she was. It has become as much history, no more, no less, than the crude yet wistfully dainty vases pounded out of shell casings in some French trench. That is the mystery of things.
"Fontaine!"
He turns, sees Clarisse there with a shopping bag in her arms.
"Clarisse!"
Something troubled there in her sea-green eyes, some worry or concern.
"You okay, then?"
"Yes," he says.
"I thought you dead, Fontaine."
"No."
"I brought you food." "The kids okay?"
"Scared," she says.
"They with Tourmaline." "I'd be scared, too, then."
A smile twitches the corner of her mouth. She comes forward, shifting the bag aside. Her lips brush his.
"Thank you,"
he says, taking the heavy bag from which fine smells arise.
"Thank you, Clarisse."
He sees tears in the corners of her eyes.
"Bastard," she says. "Where's my dolls?"
"I'm sorry," he says, as gravely as he can manage, "but they were victims of the terrible fire." And then they both start to laugh. 73. Silencio.
"Where did you find it?"
"Treasure Island," the boy lies, passing the watch, a solid brown wafer of corrosion, across the glass countertop. Silencio peers through his loop at the damp biscuit of metal. He scores the rust with a diamond scribe.
"Stainless,"
he admits, knowing the boy will know that that is good, though not good as gold, worth the price of a meal.
"I want to see you fix it," the boy says.
Silencio twists the loop from his eye and looks at the boy as if noticing him for the first time.
"I want to see you fix it,"
the boy points down, indicating the watches arrayed beneath the glass.
"The bed," Silencio says. "You were here with Sandro when we restored the Vacheron."
Silencio brings the restoration bed from the rear of the shop, a square cushion, 10 inches on a side. He places it on the counter, and the boy bends close to see the velvety green surface made up of millions of manipulators. Silencio places the watch on the bed. They watch as it rises smoothly on edge, as if of its own accord, and then seems to sink, impossibly, as if through the shallow bed and the glass beneath, vanishing like a coin set into soft mud. Silencio looks at the watch on his wrist, a military Jaeger LeCoultre, RAAF.
9 minutes, he said. "There's coffee." "I want to watch," the boy says.
"Nothing to see." Within the bed, the rusted disc of the watch is being read and disassembled. Molecules are moving. In 9 minutes it will rise again, bright and perfect as the day it first left its factory in Switzerland.
"I want to watch," the boy says.
Silencio understands. He goes to get the coffee. Thanks. To everyone who waited for this one with even greater patience than usual, particularly my publishers, as personally and wonderfully represented by Susan Allison and Tony Lacey. To Deb and Graham and Claire, with love, for putting up with far more than the ordinary basement dwelling. To Julia Whitwer, for being this text's first reader, and more. The following are special friends of this book: Gordon Begg, Judith Beale, Jessica Eastman, Carl Taro Greenfeld, Mark Halleck,
Richard Kadri, Kevin Kelly, Louisa Jean Lamb, Roger Trilling, Jack Womack, thank you all. And to the post-cyberpunk contingent in Mexico City, who, though I declined their thoughtful offer of the definitive alternative tour, encouraged me with their warm enthusiasm through the writing of a crucial chapter in the Hotel Camino Real. May 10th, 1999, Vancouver, B.C. End of All Tomorrow's Parties by William Gibson. WILLIAM GIBSON. Read by Robert O'Keefe in the studios of American Foundation for the Blind, Incorporated for the Library of Congress, April 2001. Published by G.P. Putnam Sons, a member of Penguin Putnam Incorporated, 375 Hudson Street, New York, New York, 10014. Further reproduction or distribution in other than a specialized format is prohibited. If you found any cassette in this book to be defective, please place a rubber band or piece of string around that cassette for identification. Place it in the container on top of the front stack of cassettes.